to yield tax preferences if you've already got one. Nobody likes to give up gains, usually described as hard-fought gains. But you may view it that way from the tactical point of view, but you might come out with a quite different answer if you looked at it, if one looked at it from a national point of view. So I think the windows of opportunity business is fine. The Act certainly needs tidying up. But for me, if it means kind of a crass move to how do we hold on to things just on the basis of clout or something else, it seems to me that's a little less admirable push. Now, more specifically, on the question of looked at from a state point of view as citizen or from a national point of view as opposed to this tactical one that I was earlier talking about, I think you come out oftentimes with different answers, including on the tax matter. Because again, if your proposition is to over time bring things to be normalized and equal treatment, then that includes changes in the tax matter. Now, on the Indian Reorganization Act, and I'd forgotten that IRA to me for a long time had meant that's where you put $2,000 a year in a tax deferred fashion, and I took a little while to remember that it's I think the Indian Reorganization Act, so I don't know a lot about that. But a proposition that I think may cause trouble, I think this picks up on a point or two made this morning as opposed to yesterday, was if you set up a two-track system for gain and you say, I think I'll use the Indian Claims route and the Indian Reorganization Act route and maybe a BIA route and the Public Health Service route and all those things that are specialized Indian-related matters, and that's one route for gain and arranging useful things for oneself. And then when you run that one out, or it seems to be a time that one shifts to the national political route and will deal in some kind of political settlement for other things, if you set up such a two-track system for gain, I think that invites a lot of opposition. Because it means, to me, I think, carrying on in tandem, searching for gain on the basis of differences, as long as one can, and then searching for gain in the national political scene on the basis of sameness. And I think that can invite a good deal of difficulty. Now, Byron, mentioned that my reference yesterday to maybe even attitudinal changes might have been some of the motivation of some of the framers or crafters of the legislation, and cultural changes. And he properly said, you know, what does one mean by that? What I had in mind in using those two words, that maybe attitudinal changes, was the racially based dependency, was what I was talking about. BIA, Public Health Service, things, racially based dependency, and that attitudinal changes was the way I was describing those. And I admit it's a pretty loose term, and it's totally fair to say, why did you use a phrase like that and what did you have in mind? On the matter of cultural changes, that's still tougher, but what I had in mind was that the Act, I think some folks felt, could induce or encourage cultural changes in the sense of caring more about financial, commercial, so-called market system, so-called Western financial commercial institutions is what I meant by cultural change. I wasn't talking about just destroying other more artistic and other sorts of things. Because on the Just Citizens one with Charlie Johnson, and just like everybody else, those two phrases, which I know can get pretty heavy going. Recall that what was being talked about there, at least when I used them, was I was talking about just citizens and just like everybody else in the sense of how government treats you in terms of entitlements and law and official relationships. And I suppose it's just a matter of how one views what you would like to see the long-term direction be. And for me, it is, do you want to see things promoted that keep Native America and non-Native America running in some parallel course that never gets together? Or do you want to have it go in a divergent course and be doing things officially now, is what I'm talking about, so that they go still farther apart in various ways? Or is it your view of the world, as it is mine, that over time would like to see a convergence of Native and non-Native America, and that's the longer-term thing? You're just talking about directions and thrust. We're not talking about losing identities and so on, in my view. So that was what I had in mind in using perhaps the too casual phrase, just citizen, just like everybody else. I was talking in official technical treatment. Because back to the Claims Act itself, it seemed to me that at least a lot of people felt that we were trying to do a fairly tricky thing, tricky in the sense of difficult, not in the sense of deceptive, a fairly tricky thing, and that was how to take an occasion which was inherently racially based, a legal, legitimate claim, and craft a solution in the longer term that had the chance of minimizes racial distinctions. And that, I think, was a key thrust in my recollection of the trickiness of that awful hard task. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I noticed some of you looking at your watches. I was told yesterday that we remained too long. We should have been out of here by 4 o'clock, so if it's all right with you, perhaps we might adjourn now for lunch and hear from Mr. Van Ness and Mr. Upiksoon this afternoon. And then others might consider the question that Mr. Martin put. And I know that David Case and Rosita Worrell and Chuck Smythe will have some other questions this afternoon to put to all of you. And perhaps after we hear from Mr. Van Ness and Mr. Upiksoon this afternoon, we could proceed in that way, if that's all right. And perhaps we could try for 1:15. Okay, let's begin again. Why don't we all take our seats? This Sheldon Kachetag's his sister wants to say something, and Van Ness isn't back, so I thought I'd invite her to do. What's her name again?
Bernita,
yeah. Maybe we could start. Mr. Van Ness hasn't returned, but Vernita Zillis had one or two questions, I think, she wanted to ask and points she wanted to make. So since we promised the public they could participate, I thought we could let her have the microphone for just a few minutes. And by that time, Mr. Van Ness will likely be ready to go ahead. Yeah.
Bill Van Ness said that
okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the panel. My name is Vernita Zillis. I'm from Unalakleet. I'd like to say at the outset that I came to Anchorage originally to organize and help the Alaska Native Women's statewide organization. However, Lily McGarvey, who is the president of the board of directors, was one of the panelists on Wednesday and brought me with her here to this meeting on Wednesday, and I was rather enthralled and have been enthralled since. But I am speaking today as an individual and not representing any organization. It's very hard for me to sit. I have the same feeling that Charlie had, Charlie Johnson had earlier when he said that it's hard to sit and not want to raise your hand. But I would like to make some observations on some of the things that I have heard this morning, and whenever possible, I will try to make reference to the persons who spoke. Mr. Peterson had spoken about the urban versus the village native, and I'd like to make an observation about that. He said that their viewpoints differ as to the optimum results that they would desire to attain from ANCSA, that the urban native would rather be considering the individual profit emphasis, whereas the village native would more likely consider the communal sharing of benefits, and I agree. However, I would caution that in looking at this particular viewpoint, the criteria used to determine who is urban and who is village should not be based on whether or not that person lives in the village or in the urban areas, because some village people are urban in the extreme in their viewpoints. And others follow the old dictum that you can take the native out of the village, but you can't take the village out of the native. And I have seen examples of both of this, both of these kinds of people in my experience. Byron Malott spoke about the consideration that members of the boards of directors of the corporations have to give to the attitudes of financial institutions. And I can see his viewpoint that it is necessary to consider their attitudes in order to gain their cooperation. However, to me, this is a direct example of something that I spoke about on Wednesday, which is the one-way attitude in education, where natives have traditionally and historically been forced to educate themselves toward the Western ways, methods of doing business, and there has been almost no reciprocity where the Western institutions have not educated themselves in the native ways. And when boards of directors make this consideration, maybe unintentionally, they are reinforcing that attitude that that education is only one way. Our native ways, the methods of doing business that the corporations in the villages and the regions have taken, it's not necessarily a case of better or worse. It's but the ways that they have done business are as much a fact of life as the attitudes of those financial institutions of which Mr. Malott spoke. And unless you move the villages en masse to the city, or educate the villagers who choose to stay in the village en masse to the Western ways, unless this happens, this conflict is going to continue. And as Mr. Malat said also, 20 years, that's not long enough to overcome that sort of problem. In giving us this insight on the kinds of things that successful boards of directors have to consider, and I thought it was extremely eloquent, it's also a direct example of something else that I spoke of, and that is the communications barrier that arose when members of corporate administrations and boards of directors were forced to school themselves in the corporate process, and in so doing made themselves more comfortable in the English language perhaps than they are in their various native tongues, so that when it came time to explain these kinds of things, they were at a loss as to how to explain to shareholders who were not comfortable in English this kind of problem. The boards of directors will have to take steps and this is just, it boggles the imagination, to learn the native tongue. I know that how hard it is. I had to practice for, let's see, how long does it take to fly from Nome to Unalakleet to learn just how to say a couple of sentences to my mother? Ininupiak. Isummalung naksiga, pakma ilung naksiga, kanrusiga. Ilisaut you might maka. In English, it's very emotional. In English, that means I have been thinking it is time for me to learn my own tongue. Would you teach me? So it boggles my mind, and I understand the problems that these executives face, but I think that they should make more of an effort to begin an outreach to their shareholders to explain what they're up against to make their corporation succeed in the Western sense. Mr. Malat also said that he had made reference to those people who have no economic power. And to me, it was implied that people with no economic power are pitiable. In my experience, there are people living now in the villages with no economic power whatsoever, who do not desire economic power, who use what little money they have to maintain the quality of life that they have succeeded in achieving in subsisting off the land. But whose quality of life is threatened by anxious consequences should this law's intents be subverted or foiled. On the question of unity, I think it was Mr. Yupiksoon yesterday who made reference to Frank Degnan's often quoted, "United we stand, divided we still stand." And since I am an individual speaking today, I think I can say that it's also a reality on the question of unity that in some cases, united we have stood and united we have fallen. And there are corporations faltering right now to whom this particular statement applies, no matter what the ideal is. I would like to see united we stand, divided we still stand. But there's the threat also of falling as a people. Charlie Johnson said ANCSA is an economic settlement, and he wasn't too optimistic about the impacts resulting from this economic settlement. And yes, I agree, it is an economic settlement, but as other documents like ANCSA, it is couched in terms that address the issue of justice. It has ANCSA has the face of justice. And it is this face of justice that we should use so that the lip service paid to justice within ANCSA can be made into action. I don't know if this is possible. Charlie also said that many executives have been voted out. I say that the ones that have been voted out in many cases are the ones who, when they achieved the status of being board members, realized the huge private and personal cost of maintaining a corporate position. The ones who have paid this cost have stayed in some cases. But in staying, in maintaining their corporate positions, they're paying their way into another world while simultaneously acquiring the ability to rationalize and justify the payment. And some of them rationalize for public reasons and some to be able to live with themselves. I see in listening to this hearing that there are two viewpoints that are arising. And one is the viewpoint of the corporate executive, and one is the viewpoint of the shareholders. This is kind of inevitable. The question arises when persons strive to understand the Western ways with the intention of helping their people. And when these Western concepts of economic success begin to make sense, what then happens to their native identity? I think it's important, yes, for them to achieve success for the corporations and by extension for the shareholders. But I caution that they should be aware that in understanding and making sense of the Western ways, they not step over into that other world that I spoke of. And then Mr. Parker spoke of ANCSA and said that the basic framework of the Act has been holding up. But in looking around me at the economic and social impacts of ANCSA, I wonder, when he said that, whether things are indeed going to plan. Was it the plan of ANCSA to divide families using, I don't think it was. He also asked the question, what are specific and highest priority changes desired to be accomplished? And I will reiterate what I said on Wednesday, that I feel that the children, the 20,000 or 30,000 plus children so far who are disenfranchised by ANCSA, by being born after 1971, that's the highest priority. And I will use my own example. When my daughter is 21, I'll be 51. When she's 21, I hope that she would be in a position and desirous of being able to speak for herself. However, under ANCSA, she will have no forum in which to speak for herself. And she will not have anything until I die. And I really don't plan to die when I'm 51. I would hope to live. My people have a history of longevity. And if I follow in my grandmother's footsteps, for instance, I'm going to be 79, 80, 80-some years old before I die. And she will then be middle-aged and have children and grandchildren of her own. This, to me, is the highest priority, that we take care of these people. Finally, and I don't know how appropriate this particular statement will be to this forum, but for all of the plaudits that have been leveled at the grassroots effort to understand ANCSA, I find that as a grassroots native, and to a lesser extent, some places and some times, and to a greater extent at others, as a woman, that my opinions are suspect because I am not affiliated with properly recognized institutions. I am not a board member of any corporation. In this respect, sophisticated natives who do belong sometimes are capable of a perhaps more virulent bias than their non-native peers. Yet I am not a radical. Unless the definition of a radical is one who thinks and asks questions but does not run for office. I've had a native person say to me, you know, boy, you really could have been something with an education. What am I now? What's the something that I lack without the education? I know one thing, that it's not, I do not lack my native identity. I know who I am and what I can do. I think that hearings such as this have been a help. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Upikson, please go ahead. You have, Mr. Van Ness, I understand, has given you his time, and you have your own as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you are a driving force, the first thing I have to say is I'm a landlord. I'll tell the commissioner, you haven't paid your rent yet. Having made that statement, I have proof of being surrounded by the best technical people to say Joe is not blowing his stack. Now, we get into some other statements that I will make now, and will simply tell you that, look, when I made my previous statements. I said that in this white man's world, we need white man's tools. The Arctic Slope Native Association went beyond ANCSA and ANILCA because we were surrounded by technical people that kept us advised of how Congress was moving. Now, let me get down to what I feel about the leadership in this one piece of instrument, one white man tool, that's only one. When you define what a leader is, you have to understand that he has the ability to influence human behavior. On the other hand, set a very good example too, and really come out for tougher goals. Now, that giving you the definition of what a leader is, but to some they'll tell me that, look, Joe, when you define a leader, it's that fine line between the hook and the sinker. That's different language. When I say that the Alaska Native Land Claims itself was just one of those tools, we as leaders had to seek some other course to resolve the problems that were identified by using another method. Now, I have 8 months of combat, and that's in Korea. My chances of coming out alive was that I wanted to be the leader because I know if I'm the leader, I'm going to come out alive. But during the course of those 8 months, the biggest enemy that I had was my own American GI rather than the enemy, because I looked like a Korean, and by golly, when you are an American GI and you're afraid of your own troops rather than the enemy, then that's a different experience. It is a hairy experience. Under the involvement that I had in fighting for my country, I went through a lot of leadership reaction tests. I had to prove that I was worthy. And when you go through 36 hours of reaction tests, that's an experience. Now, having all this behind me, I understood regimentation and learned how to develop new leaders. I can't carry the ball by myself. I need some help. The way you do it is you delegate authority, but when you do it, you have to make sure that that man is honorable. I handpick people. In fact, being associated with Fred Paul and our ability to cause the Western civilization to support our side of causing Congress to move was that we told the Western civilization, especially the Pacific Northwest, you write to your congressman, your senator, and we'll tell you, we'll show you what impact it's going to have on your economy. Because when you look to the state of Alaska, its mineral wealth, I can go deeply into Adam Smith. In fact, he wrote the book for me, but he never knew anything about Indian law. Now, having this one white man tool now is not the cure-all. It isn't. There are a lot of faults in the Claims Act, but when you listen to your own people, they identify their problems, and it's up to the leadership to find the answers and cure it. Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, as I said, Arctic Slope Native Association was beyond it. That's why when I made my earlier statement that, look, we know that Arctic Slope Native Association is going to get 5 million acres, but we came into this with 56.5 million acres, and we were losing control over 51.5 million acres. Okay, there are other ways that we still can maintain control if we are going to survive as landlords, and that is the Alaska State Constitution. Those framers were beautiful when they wrote the borough concept. I think we surprised them when we approached the Voluntary Borough Act concept and got our people involved in it so that they elected to incorporate as a borough. We knew that we had the population, we had our own mayor, we had our own assemblyman, we had an independent school district, well financed. Now, we could never get out of BIA. No, I dislike going to Congress every year for the appropriation to support a BIA educational system. I hate to go to Juneau to fight for my peace of the revenues that are being developed from my land. So one way to do that is cause your own villages to really understand grassroots. I want you to tell me what you want in terms of self-determination. Right now, Alaska state government is getting too big. The federal government has been too big. There is lacking what we call free enterprise. What I am going to eventually close with is that my opening remarks was saying that in this white man's world, we need those white man's tools. And the Claims Act was only part of it. And it can never resolve the complaints we get from our stockholders, but we, as board members and stewards, have to acknowledge that. And right now, I cannot make a commitment unless I have specific instructions for my board of directors. I was able to keep my president and my chairman of the board advised of what was happening, and I asked him, what do you want me to do? Well, you've been involved in the Claims Act, and we don't authorize you to say anything other than what the Claims Act means and the definition of another tool. I think I've said my piece.
Thank you, Mr. Upikson. Well, David Case had some questions that he wanted to put, and perhaps you could go ahead, David.
Okay, thank you. My questions, I have three at the moment, and two of them are, I think, interrelated, and one is separate, and I think they're all to Doug Jones. the Claims Act has often been characterized, and I think President Nixon did this too, as the first of the self-determination pieces of legislation. And the term has come up here too. Mr. Upuksen just referred to it. But we really haven't talked about that very much as an item of or a concept in public policy. And my question is, what is your recollection or your perception of the idea of self-determination being a public policy concept at the time that the Claims Act was being crafted? Was it part of the policy considerations that went into the Claims Act? And then I guess the next part of that question is, if it was, then how specifically, not completely, but specifically, do you see that the Claims Act addressed that policy consideration?
What are the other two questions?
There's one other question, but it's unrelated to this one, really.
Could we tackle that one first, Mr. Jones, and then...
Well, not tackle it very well, I guess. Perhaps, David, you'd help the question out a little bit more, though, if you'd mention to me what you think surrounds the self-determination question.
Well, that's the point of the question.
Well, perhaps, although... if you don't, then I have to say, well, I don't remember the phrase self-determination being a central one in a lot of the discussions surrounding it. Now, if you mean by self-determination, though, some of the things I was, as Howard Cosell would say, alluding to on relations, perhaps changed relations with Public Health Service and BIA, that sort of thing, the dependency question, then I'd answer a little differently. But if the phrase self-determination, as you use it, is one of those crucial phrases like termination was or is, and a handful of a few others, I'd say that was not one that I recall as frequently surrounding discussions on the issue.
I disagree slightly in this sense, that I think Doug is exactly right in that there was no academically styled policy debate over what self-determination was in the legal sense and some conscious decision made to promote it in a strict legal sense in the Act. But I think that those words came up, I would say, I recollect them coming up fairly often in the context that Doug mentioned, and that is that there was clearly a reaction against the kind of settlement that had been visited upon tribes in the lower 48, which was regarded in, you know, sort of the buzzword on the other side of the ledger, paternalism, the reservation status. And to the extent that whole issue was resolved, it's like some of the others that I differed with my friend Dave Hickok on. I don't think they were discussed a great deal, but I think they were mentioned. I think there was a conscious decision to have this settlement involve self-determination, and the manifestation of that self-determination was essentially what we got in ANCSA, the corporate structure, the fee conveyance of land, and the idea, particularly in the, maybe I saw it more starkly than Doug did on the House side, because as someone mentioned, Wayne Aspinall, who was the chairman of the Interior Committee at the time, may very well have had in his mind ANCSA being a kind of a subtle termination sort of statute. And so he may well have accepted, without saying so, some notion of self-determination, but in his mind, and I'm projecting here, the cost for that in terms of the corporate structure and fee simple was, do not expect to return again, nor expect that you will receive the same level of benefits from the federal government, even though in the final negotiations over ANCSA, it became clear that Mr. Aspinall and his general philosophy with regard to the reduction of federal services and federal benefits to Alaska Natives could not be meaningfully reduced by virtue of this act.
That the services could not be meaningfully reduced?
That's right. I think in the final analysis, the notion that that at least I took away, and which was tried later in various ways, was that there would not be a meaningful reduction of federal services. And the 2C study, is that the right? Yeah, the 2C study was, I think, seen in different ways by different people. But I have a feeling that Mr. Aspinall may have left the table thinking that the 2C study would prove that those services were too much, and some years hence, that those services were still great, they were still costly, and therefore there should be a policy decision made to reduce them. I think other people left the table feeling that the 2C study had the potential to prove the value of those services and the importance of them in an overall scheme. I know I can speak for myself that there was no question in my mind, and several people have said it. I think Byron said it, and I believe Joe said it yesterday, and I've written it several times. The Native Land Claim Settlement, in my view, was never a piece of social or cultural litigation. It was basically a business deal. It was the settlement of a piece of litigation on economic terms. And to the extent that it had substantial social and economic implications, but when people left the table, it seemed to me that it was essentially an economic settlement of a legal claim.
To respond to your question, Joe, by self-determination, and this is kind of an historical interest, because the policy seemed to have been thought about around the time of the Claims Act and maybe have been discussed or even voiced publicly by President Nixon. And then it later became a statute with that name, the Self-Determination Act. So I guess I think of self-determination as it's been later evolved as involving institutions or resources or both that over which natives have a great deal of substantial control, if not complete control, and the policy has been one that developing or transferring to native control institutions that had been under other forms of control. And so I